Ethics, who needs them? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A plan to gut an independent congressional ethics office is reversed in Washington. Some outside observers say America should practice what it preaches.
The moral authority that the U.S. has been attaining through decades is at stake.
Plus, a family's decision to leave Turkey after a string of attacks.
We feel terrible about leaving. We feel like we're abandoning our friends here. But when we started to tell our Turkish friends, you know, the first thing they said was kind of, what took you so long? And we wish we could go with you.
And a musician reflects on why he sings.
We're living through a turbulent moment in history. Within the music, there is the flame of hope.
That's all ahead today on The World. As a global superpower, the U.S. leans on a couple of things to persuade others to follow. One is military might. The other is moral authority. The latter may have taken a hit over the latest ethics controversy in Congress. Last night, House Republicans voted to gut the powers of an independent Office of Congressional Ethics. Today, they withdrew the plan under heavy criticism, including from President-elect Trump. We wondered how this resonates in Latin America, where a number of countries have battled with ethics controversies. Alejandro Salas is with Transparency International. He says the most corrupt nations in the region are not usually the most impoverished, but the ones with the weakest institutions.
If you look, for example, at Venezuela, which is a country that has been dominated very strongly in more than a decade by a strong president that controls the electoral authority. A lot of the media is not independent anymore, the prosecutors, etc. Then corruption and state capture are very common. No, that's an extreme case. The U.S., on the other hand, historically has had very strong institutions that create checks and balances, and through the autonomy, they can control those they are meant to be controlling. So that's why the U.S., yes, usually they take this moral high ground, this lecturing, but they have respect because the U.S. institutions in general, not all of them, but in general, have had a proper role. But now, nowadays, I'm very worried. I have to say personally, I'm very worried, not only from what happened today with the discussion in the Congress about the ethics office, but also this issue that the president doesn't have to hold certain rules and there's no conflict of interest.
Yeah, so what do you think is happening to the moral authority of the United States?
Americans have some sort of different concept of corruption. It seems to be something more of a moral issue, a more personal moral issue, rather than this more universal understanding that institutions need to be clean. It's not about individuals. It's not about candidate A or candidate B or Congressman A or Congressman B is clean or decent or good or bad. It's about the strength of the institutions. And I'm worried, stemming from the campaign in 2016, with many of the things that President-elect Trump is doing, like saying, well, no problem for me with a conflict of interest, or appointing people that are likely to have conflict of interest and that they are not disclosing their whole tax history. You know, these things are on the table, and I'm not accusing anyone because maybe it's too early to say, but the fact that these things are called into question and are constantly in the news is a yellow light, at least, that we need to have and pay attention to closely.
Right. Well, the Republicans in the House of Representatives today reversed course and decided not to make dramatic changes to the Independent Office of Congressional Ethics. But I'm curious, how does even hearing these sorts of debates, how does that resonate in Latin America?
Well, it definitely is. It's very bad, no? Because one has to lead by example. If you look in the recent past, many of the big scandals at the global level, for example, FIFA, or last year there was also a scandal in the United Nations, and more recently with Odebrecht, no, the huge Brazilian construction company linked to the Petrobras scandal. the U.S. has been prosecuting and has been chasing and has been putting a stop to the, even to these global corruption problems. So we have to be very careful that the U.S. doesn't start sending the wrong messages, because then where would be the moral authority, and not even the moral authority, but also the practical solutions and the ideas on how to deal with potential corruption, with conflicts of interest, with nepotism in Venezuela or in Argentina or in Brazil or around the world.
Alejandro Salas, Transparency International's Regional Director for the Americas. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks to you.
Watching out for and preventing corruption and conflicts of interest is obviously important, but our next story takes ethical issues to a whole nother level. It's about politicians sabotaging peace efforts for no purpose other than their own political gain. Think about it, letting people continue to kill and be killed for the sake of one man's ambition. The man in this case was Richard Milhouse Nixon. The war, of course, was Vietnam. Newly found documents seem to connect Nixon himself to efforts to sabotage the Paris peace talks in the fall of 1968. The world's history guy Chris Wolf has been looking over the evidence. Pretty extraordinary if this is all true. What is the evidence?
Well, I think we should just set the picture for listeners first, Marco. So let me quickly set the scene. 1968 was by far the bloodiest year of the Vietnam War for U.S. troops. More than 16,000 died. Tens of thousands were wounded. Many of the battles and those broken faces were seen live on TV. And U.S. public opinion obviously is starting to turn against the war. And it's an election year, right? So Nixon is the Republican candidate. He's not president yet. He's just an ordinary citizen. President Lyndon B. Johnson is stepping down, but he's making an all-out effort to stop the war. There's been talks with the Soviets who've agreed that they'll bring the North Vietnamese to the table if the U.S. can deliver the South Vietnamese, and everything's looking pretty rosy.
Yeah, it sounds pretty hopeful. What went wrong, though?
The South Vietnamese wouldn't play ball. They just procrastinated and ended up being half-hearted in the entire peace process. Now, U.S. intelligence at the time found a direct trail from the South Vietnamese government back to the Nixon campaign. The intelligence was talking about an effort to monkey wrench the talks from the Nixon campaign because he didn't want the Democrats to look good, and it would help his political chances if the talks failed or were delayed. And now Johnson, at the time, before the election, was furious, but he refused to go public in the absence of any hard evidence linking Nixon himself to these efforts. In fact, it's something that Nixon denied to his dying day, that he would ever, he just couldn't contemplate in his conscience any thought about trying to sabotage the peace talks. It turns out that was a lie as well.
Yes. Yeah, so help us understand this, because as you say, Nixon was a private citizen. He wasn't even president-elect yet. And what was the evidence connecting Nixon to the South Vietnamese?
Well, we have to give credit here to historian John Farrell, who found the notes kept by one of Nixon's top advisors, a guy called H.R. Haldeman, that listeners may remember later became chief of staff to Nixon and was one of the men prosecuted for the Watergate affair. So what he's found are notes of phone conversations that Haldeman had with Nixon dated October 22nd, 1968. So we're talking about 2 weeks before the election. And these include things like keep Anna Chenault working on SVN. Now, Anna Chenault was a woman whose husband had fought with China in World War II and was very closely connected to the South Vietnamese regime. And she was one of the people identified by U.S. intelligence as working to deliberately persuade them to scupper the peace talks. And they knew that she talked about having a message from the boss, like, keep fighting, you know, we're going to in this to win it kind of thing. And the evidence is that Nixon was trying to get her to continue to work on the South Vietnamese. There's other ways, he uses the phrase himself, any other way to monkey wrench it, literally to scupper the talks, anything else that he can do to help.
So maybe not a smoking gun, but maybe a gun with some smoke coming out of it. Do historians agree with this view?
A lot of them do, and a lot of people have actually used that phrase. This is the smoking gun that we've suspected for a long time. A few are a bit more cautious. The New York Times has a great survey of several historians in its coverage today, and you can see there that there's some who have reservations, but most are overwhelmingly of the opinion that this is the smoking gun.
Yeah, so as far as taking ethical issues to a whole new level this episode, I mean, how many Americans died after the Paris peace talks broke down?
21,200 plus. And then, of course, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese and other people in Southeast Asia.
Did the world miss a chance to end the Vietnam War in 1968?
It's possible. A lot of Historians, though, think it's not plausible that the South Vietnamese didn't really need much persuasion to drag their feet or to try to scupper the talks. But we'll never know.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe, thanks for telling us about this.
Thank you, Marco.
4 pounds. That's how much trash, on average, each of us here in the U.S. generates every day. That's a lot of stuff going into landfills. Sweden has a plan, though, to try to reduce its waste. The World's Jason Margolis has our story.
You wear your jeans a lot. Eventually, they start to get a hole. What do? You throw them away and buy a new pair, of course. Everybody knows that. But Sweden's Minister of Financial Markets and Consumer Affairs, Per Borlund, says we need to change that mindset.
Part of that is making it more affordable and economically rational to stop buying and throwing away and instead repairing your goods and using it for a longer time.
Borlund is trying to push people in that direction through tax breaks. He spearheaded a 50% tax cut for Swedes to repair clothes, shoes, and bicycles. This idea, not just discarding stuff, it's not exactly revolutionary.
Clothing used to be repaired.
That's Robert Ross, a sociologist at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. He says not long ago there were tailors and cobblers here in the U.S.
And if you had a tear in a sock, somebody in your family darned the toe of the heel.
Sounds quaint today. But let's say you're Swedish and a zipper breaks, and it costs $20 to repair that. On top of that, you'd also pay a 25% value-added tax, or $5 more. After January 1st, the tax on repairs would be cut in half. Ross thinks this tax cut is a well-intentioned idea, but
I don't think that that's going to make the difference between somebody getting a pair of pants let out or a heel on a shoe.
Okay, fair enough. But the new Swedish law also applies to bigger-ticket household appliances, things like refrigerators and washing machines. If Swedes repair those items, they can take a 50% tax deduction off the cost of the labor. In high-tax Sweden, that can amount to substantial savings. But again, it's all about the bottom line. Consider my ancient lawnmower. Every time I yank the string to start her up once, twice, three times, I just don't know if the lawn is getting cut that day.
Pliers.
Mike Daly teaches repair classes in Indiana for yard tools.
Lawnmowers, chainsaws, snowblowers.
I asked him, when my mower does go kablooey, what should I do? He says hourly rates to fix a lawnmower in Indiana are about $70 to $80 an hour.
So you could be looking at $150 to $170 to repair that lawnmower. Wouldn't be worth it if it's 10 years old and you paid $100 to begin with, unless maybe it had some sentimental value.
It doesn't. But let me throw some numbers at you. Stay with me here. Let's say I have a $500 Craftsman Deluxe mower. Now I hire the Swedish version of Mike Daly at $80 an hour. With the tax break, he'll really only be costing me half that much. Now, if I'm a Swede, I'm probably thinking twice about getting a new mower. That's largely the point of the new Swedish rule, says sociologist Robert Ross. Remember, he thinks the tax break is too insignificant to bother fixing a pair of jeans, but he does think the new law can get Swedes thinking differently about what they buy. More durable items worth keeping and repairing.
Fewer better is better than more cheaper.
Better for the environment and perhaps better for jobs too. Sweden's Consumer Affairs Minister Per Borlund says the new law will put more Swedes to work repairing stuff. But isn't the point of a modern, healthy economy to constantly produce, to buy and sell stuff? Borlund says there are other ways to grow, and it's not helping Sweden's economy when somebody in Stockholm buys a new TV.
Most of the electronic goods that we use are imported. Repairing your goods is quite labor-intense as compared to production, so we believe that if consumption behavior is altered, this can lead to a boost in the employment and the labor market.
Borlund adds that the tax cut for repairs is just one part of a larger strategy to promote sustainable consumption. He says the government's role is to move the needle, so taking care of the planet becomes not just a moral decision, but an economically rational one, too. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Coming up, drones in Syria in the fight to save antiquities. That's on The World. The conflict in Syria and the battle against ISIS are both being fought on Turkey's doorstep, and increasingly Turkey itself is the battleground. The latest example was the attack on a nightclub in Istanbul on New Year's Eve. 39 people were killed and many more were injured. ISIS claimed responsibility, and the gunman who carried out the attack is still at large. Christina Asquith is editor of our Across Women's Lives desk, and she's been based in Istanbul for the past 2.5 years. She's now decided to leave Turkey. So, Christina, what made you decide to pack up? Was the attack on the disco on New Year's Eve kind of the last straw?
Yeah, it's been a really difficult decision, and it's one we've been mulling over for about 6 months now. My husband and I are both conflict reporters, and we've lived in Baghdad and Afghanistan, so we're certainly comfortable with a level of risk, and we've got a large number of Turkish friends here with kids in the schools, and, you know, life goes on. But it's just the kind of incessant number of attacks coming at us day after day and often hitting very close to home that's really made us say that, you know, this is enough now, we've got to go.
And the fact that you've got kids, do you think that kind of played more heavily into your decision to leave?
It's really the only reason why we are leaving. You know, when the Besiktas bombing at the football stadium happened just before Christmas, earlier that day, I was taking my kids back from the Istanbul Contemporary Art Museum on that road right in front of the stadium. And, you know, when the bomb happened itself, I was in my bedroom and I actually went onto my phone to check the weather app because we had a party planned the next day and I was surprised. I thought it was thunder. And the same thing with the shooting at the Reina nightclub on New Year's Eve. You know, I was at my house, I was about to go to bed. And I thought I heard like my baby crying, and I kind of walked over to my door to listen, and I realized it was sirens from a police car. And then a couple hours later, we saw, you know, when we woke up, we saw the news.
Have your kids been asking about all of this stuff?
Well, that's the other thing. You know, we all try and protect them. We don't show television at home, and they don't really read the headlines in the newspapers yet. But the other day, our 7-year-old came home from school and asked me why was the Besiktas football stadium bombed. And, you know, I had no answer.
I know there's still a lockdown and a nationwide manhunt for the suspect for that New Year's Eve attack. I mean, we had a taste of that kind of anxious moment for several days here in Boston after the Marathon bombing, nearly 2-day period. Nobody left their homes. What does it feel like in Turkey?
It feels a lot like that. But there is a sense here in Turkey that it's not just a one-off. I mean, first of all, in Boston, of course, I spoke the language, I knew the streets, I could read the newspapers. But there was also a sense in Boston that this was just really, these were lone wolves. Here in Istanbul, you know, they've already arrested 8 other people who they're saying are accomplices. There's just more of a sense that, you know, that there could be dangers around other corners. And as someone who speaks English and has a very kind of Western-looking family walking through the streets, not knowing who is friendly and who is not, you know, that it's just that unnerving sense that there could be a moment of or an attack around the corner. And how can you enjoy your life like that?
So just give us a sense of what's changed for you in the 2.5 years you've lived in Istanbul.
I would say the real turning point happened about 8 months ago with a bombing on Istiklal Street, which is kind of the Times Square of Turkey. It's an area heavily populated with tourists. And even though not many people were killed and it didn't make huge headlines in the U.S., it really was this moment where foreigners said, okay, they're after us now specifically, and we have a bullseye on our back. And you really started to see the foreigners leaving very quickly. I mean, almost all of my foreign friends, especially the ones with kids who aren't journalists, have gone now. And you see the international schools, you know, their enrollment has been cut in half. And certainly a lot of the areas that have foreign clientele, they're closed down now. So there's just this sense of like escape, of we need to get out of here, of panic almost, that's setting in across the city. And, you know, we stuck it out longer than most. I mean, there was the coup over the summer and then the airport attacks. And still we felt like, you know, look, we go to school every day. We take our kids to school and it's hundreds of Turkish children. And of course, they're living here and it's going to be fine. But you know, at a certain point, you're talking with the parents on the playground about where the next bomb's going to be. And you have to step back and say, like, look, I'm in a privileged position of being able to leave, and I should. And the funny thing is, you know, we feel terrible about leaving. We feel like we're abandoning our friends here and our colleagues. But when we started to tell our Turkish friends, you know, the first thing they said was kind of like, what took you so long? And we wish we could go with you.
Wow. So, I mean, do you have any friends that are upset or kind of chiding you for leaving?
We have friends that are Turkish journalists and Turkish academics. And they are particularly being targeted right now, not by ISIS or the terrorists, but by the government and by this crackdown on freedom and democracy that's happening across the country right now. And so, you know, they're already dealing with so much. And when they found out that, you know, we're pulling our daughters out of the school and their children's friend is going to be gone, and they have to have that conversation with them about why their friend is leaving the country, it, you know, it just felt like a little bit more salt in the wounds. And some of them, you know, they understood, but of course you see it in their eyes. The worry only gets more deep.
Christina Asquith, editor of the World's Across Women's Lives desk, about to depart her base in Istanbul. Christina, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
A quick look ahead now at a story we'll have for you tomorrow. It's about a new book that's just come out. It's called The Lost City of the Monkey God. Kind of sounds like an Indiana Jones movie, right? Well, for good reason.
As we moved through the jungle, we could see nothing but leaves until we practically walked into it. We had to win every foot by machete, our blades marked with stripes of pink day-glow tape so we could avoid one another's slashing strokes cutting through the vegetation.
That's Douglas Preston, the book's co-author. Tomorrow, he'll tell us more about how he and a group of archaeologists managed to find a long-lost city in the middle of a thick jungle in Honduras.
To be honest with you, you couldn't see anything. If this jungle were put down in Times Square and you were put in the middle of it, you wouldn't know you were in a city. It was so thick.
Wow.
But we were walking past the base of this pyramid, and a shout went up, "Wait, there's some weird stones over here." And we all rushed over, and the first thing I saw was this jaguar head, snarling, amazing sculpture, coming out of the ground.
You'll have to tune in tomorrow to hear the rest right here on The World. And still to come today on the show, how drones are helping to virtually preserve the ancient city of Palmyra in the middle of Syria's war.
The drone technology was very good because it is possible to take thousands of pictures in just 1 hour or 2 hours and come back with all this data and use this data for processing a 3D model.
Stick around to hear how that may lead to actual preservation of the antiquities in Palmyra. You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. David Kong's father was born in what is now North Korea. Both father and son now live in California. But the younger Kong has a dream of a unified Korea.
I would love to fly to Seoul with my father, rent a car and drive, and go see where he was born.
That story coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In case you're wondering whether our president-elect's tweets have an impact beyond U.S. borders, consider this. Today, South Korea said that one of Donald Trump's recent tweets is a clear warning to North Korea. Here's the background of this story. On Sunday, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un gave a speech in which he said his country is close to test-launching an intercontinental ballistic missile. Translation, North Korea may soon have a nuclear weapon capable of reaching the United States. No one is sure if that's really the case, but yesterday, Trump responded via Twitter. He said, quote, "It won't happen." Trump spokeswoman Kellyanne Conway told ABC that the president-elect was putting North Korea on notice with that tweet. We'll have to wait and see how North Korea responds. Right now, though, we're going to step back from the scale of global politics to bring the story down to the scale of human lives and the way North Korea and nuclear weapons have shaped one family. Daniel Gross has their story.
10 years ago, David C. Kong walked from South Korea to North Korea. At the border, guards inspected his American passport. They didn't like it when he tried to snap some pictures, but they let him through. And on the other side was an industrial city called Kaesong.
It was emotional just to go through, just to be in the northern side and with real North Korean people and talking to them. It was awesome.
Kaesong was a collaboration between two longtime adversaries. Companies from South Korea employed 50,000 workers from North Korea. For Kong, the city was a glimmer of hope, a symbol of Korean unity. But the teamwork didn't last. Last year, after North Korea claimed to test a hydrogen bomb, the project was shut down.
politics took over, and so we're back now to where we were 10 years ago.
David Kong directs the Korean Studies Center at the University of Southern California, and one of his interests is nuclear weapons. So the trip to North Korea taught him a lot, but it also had personal significance.
My father was originally born in Northern Korea. At the time, it was one, under Japanese occupation.
Growing up, Kong heard stories about Korea before the division. The peninsula had a 1,000-year history of unity, and the Kong family lived through it.
I am the 39th generation of this family, right? My son and daughter, the 40th generation of these Kongs. And that's an extraordinary sense of belonging. Not to a political regime, like, you know, no, I'm not a Korean citizen, right? But to a family and to a land and to a place. It's an extraordinary sense of belonging.
The paradox of the two Koreas is that they're unusually divided and unusually connected. Kong has made it his job to try and understand that.
In large part, my career has been made because, you know, sort of a personal interest in all of this. You can't deny I study international relations and nuclear weapons in North Korea because of where my father's from and where our family's from.
I asked Kong how his father felt about North Korea, and I expected him to tell me more stories he'd heard as a kid. But instead, he told me to visit the city of Livermore, California, and find out for myself.
Name is Sang-wook Kang. Kang is the last name. K-A-N-G. Retired from the Lawrence Livermore National Lab.
These days, the elder Kong is 81. He lives in the north, and his son lives in the south. Of California, that is. I asked Kong Sr. how he came from Korea to Livermore Lab, which happens to be a national center for nuclear weapons research. It was a winding journey, and it started when Kong was 10.
More than 60 years ago. No, 7 years ago. If I let myself go, then the childhood memories, people, and the beautiful countryside evoke very fond memories.
Kong remembers ice skating in winter and swimming in summer. His ancestors had lived in the same part of Northern Korea for centuries.
They grew up there, they got older.
But in 1945, all that changed. World War II ended, the occupying Japanese army left Korea, and in the north, communism took over. Under communism, landowners lost their rights. The elder Kong's grandfather had a deed to their land, which was suddenly meaningless.
Then he one day burned the deeds. He says, "In my lifetime, I'll never go back."
The whole family moved south, to Seoul.
The sad state of affairs, same people being divided into, was, to me, very unfortunate.
Kong wanted to study physics, but post-war South Korea could barely provide electricity and sanitation for its citizens, let alone conduct science experiments. So Kong finally decided to move to the U.S., all by himself. He always planned to go back, but he liked America. He agreed with the American stance against communism.
I was 20 and a half when I came to this country. Then I said, man, I hate communism.
Physics led Kong to UC Berkeley, where he met his American wife. From there, he moved to a lab in New York, and then back to California, the Livermore National Laboratory. And here, in the 1970s, his anti-communist stance mattered a lot. Remember, the United States was facing off against the Soviet Union. When Kong joined the laboratory, he was asked a question. If the U.S. wanted him to work on nuclear weaponry, would he work on it? Kong said yes.
We have to have strong club just to give them the message. We have to make them feel that we are stronger. To do that, the only way is nuclear.
Basically, Kong is talking about a central Cold War concept, deterrence. The idea that when two countries have the power to destroy each other, neither one will. Most of Kong's research had to do with energy projects like solar and geothermal. But I asked Kong if he ended up working on nuclear weapons, too. He wouldn't answer directly. Defense work was shrouded in secrecy. So that means that if you did work on nuclear weapons, you wouldn't necessarily be able to talk about it.
I wouldn't, no. Mum is the word.
Kong's home in Livermore is thousands of miles from his homeland of Korea. But in a way, his work at a nuclear laboratory connected him to the Cold War. And the Cold War stretched all the way from California to Korea. That's how the younger Kong, David, first got interested in nuclear weapons.
Even when, as a kid growing up, they always said, like in the 70s, if there's a nuclear exchange, we're number two on the Soviet list of targets.
David Kong said his father sometimes told stories, for example, about war games they played at work. Once, a bunch of Livermore scientists tried to estimate the damage that a nuclear attack might cause.
So what you do is you've got a lot of data on how things burn and blow up, and you know how nuclear weapons work. And so they took one model city, and he said they happened to have a lot of information about Detroit. And so they modeled what would happen if they nuked Detroit.
When the Soviet Union dissolved 25 years ago, deterrence may have seemed a lot less relevant. But in 2006, North Korea tested its first nuclear weapon. And suddenly, the same principle of deterrence applied to Kong's homeland.
Everywhere else in the world, no matter how bad it is, the Cold War is over. Right? Like, everywhere else, that's gone, except one place, and that's North and South Korea. And in a way, the fact that North Korea has nuclear weapons is, sadly, one of the reasons that unification or solving the problem is so hard, right? They have nuclear weapons precisely because it serves an end. It serves a purpose for North Korea, which is it keeps us from attacking them.
In other words, that same Cold War logic that the elder Kong brought home from work makes it incredibly difficult for the two Koreas to reunify. I wanted to know if David Kong thinks he'll ever see a reunified Korea. He's confident it will happen one day. The Cold War taught us that, too. Eventually, a stalemate has to end. But he worries it might take a while.
If that day comes, what will you be doing? What will you be looking forward to do? Or what will you be worried about?
I would love to fly to Seoul with my father. Wow, this is emotional. Rent a car and drive and go see where he was born. Wow. Well, I haven't even thought of that. That's what I will do.
When I visited David's father, I asked him what his hometown might look like today. And to answer that question, he showed me a book on his shelf about the Korean War.
And they show maps of the progress of front lines, see? And they show the line right in our neighborhood. So
your hometown became the front lines of the war?
Yes. My guess is that the village is completely gone, destroyed in 1950, October. My home.
Before I left, I told Kong what his son David had said, that he dreams of seeing where the family comes from.
He talked about wanting to go back there with you.
Yes.
Maybe one day, he said. Maybe one
while
day.
While I'm alive.
What do you think?
Yes.
Do you think it's possible?
You mean the reunification?
For you to see it.
My hope was, let's say, scale of 0 to 10 was like 9, 30 years ago. It's now down to 1. Mm-hmm. Used to be high. And then especially the prospect of my being alive with my son. So I'm glad that to pass on that desire to my son because he's a good son. Proud of him.
For The World, Daniel Gross, Livermore, California.
Daniel's story is part of our Nuclear Family series about the human relationships that keep us safe in the atomic age. You can find other stories from the series at PRI.org/nuclearfamily. Shifting gears now, Much of the big news that happens in Brazil comes out of the bigger cities on the coast, like Rio and Sao Paulo. But the news that shook Brazilians yesterday came from the Amazon region and the city of Manaus. A prison riot there left 56 inmates dead. It was the worst violence inside a Brazilian jail in recent memory. Some of the bodies were mutilated and burned. Many Brazilian officials are blaming the riot on a turf war between rival drug gangs. The World's Will Carlos has been following the story.
Most of the victims were members of the PCC, that's the Primeiro Comando do Capital, or First Command of the Capital. And this is an interesting group. Most experts agree it's the most powerful criminal organization, the biggest drug gang in Brazil. And in some irony, it was actually formed as a sort of a self-defense group within a prison, and largely in response to a really horrendous prison riot back in the 1990s in the Carandiru prison, where more than 100 people were slaughtered by prison workers. And this was one of the gangs that formed in response to that, to actually protect prisoners.
Yes, so was this massacre, as we are hearing from the state prison secretary of Amazonas State, kind of a feud between gangs?
It's hard to tell yet, and we should stress that, but certainly there's been an increasing escalation in tension between gangs. And what it looks like is that this was between a sort of a much smaller gang based in the Amazon and the PCC. And there are a couple of different theories. It could be that the smaller gang was sort of acting as a proxy for the sort of second biggest gang in Brazil that is based in Rio de Janeiro, which is the Comando Vermelho, the Red Command. So that's one of the theories, that this is sort of a clash between those two big gangs. Another theory is that the PCC was trying to kind of muscle in on some of the smaller gangs' smuggling routes through the Amazon. So we're not quite clear, but certainly that's a part of it.
And how do you pacify a prison when the gangs seem to hold sway?
That's what they're trying to figure out. And this, it should be said, is the latest and bloodiest in a string of riots and killings in Brazilian prisons over the last few months and couple of years. The problem is that these organizations are just so vast and so powerful. If you spend any time in São Paulo and you talk to people who live there, there's very much an ethos that these prison gang leaders who are imprisoned actually still run the city of São Paulo. They can, at the click of their fingers, call for general strikes and for things to be shut down. So incredibly, incredibly difficult and intractable problem to deal with.
So is it leading, or could it lead to escalating violence in other prisons around the country?
That's the worry, and not just in the prisons. Recently, we've seen reports that the PCC has taken over the favela of Rocinha, which is the biggest favela in Rio de Janeiro, a few miles from my house. And that's really, really troubling a lot of experts, because Rio is largely under the command of the Comando Vermelho, the Red Command. And this is seen as an incursion into the city, into a very lucrative drug market. So the worry is that the PCC will come in and will start to fight territory wars, try to take over Rio de Janeiro, and that's not what anybody wants.
For people who live in those favelas, when they think about, you know, this trouble coming in from hundreds of miles away, what are they thinking about these riots?
Well, man, I was in Cidade de Deus, the City of God favela, which is another huge sprawling favela just a few miles away from Rocinha, one of the other big drug centers. And the friends that I know who live there are really, really worried about this. They see the PCC as a kind of almost an invading force, and they're worried that this gang will start to lead incursions into their favela, try to take over more territory. And that's never good for the residents who are just trying to get on with their lives in between.
The World's Will Carlos, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. The war in Syria has many worried about the country's future, Syrians especially, of course, but some are also worried about preserving Syria's past. Take the ancient city of Palmyra. ISIS militants destroyed part of it, and they rigged many of the remaining sites with explosives. So an architect working with the Syrian government had an idea: send in a drone. The results are on display at an exhibit in Paris. Yves Ubelman is the architect. He describes what it was like working in a war zone.
The situation wasn't very stable, and it was difficult for us, you know, to stay on the site. So it was, for us, very quick. And the drone technology was very good, because it is possible to take thousands of pictures in just 1 hour or 2 hours and come back with all this data and use this data for processing a 3D model.
Yeah, so what did you see exactly, and how much of Palmyra had been destroyed before you got in with your drones?
For the site, we saw the Temple of Bel also completely destroyed, only stone on the ground. But some blocks are still conserved. So we can imagine to use this block to rebuild some part of the temple.
So you returned to Paris with these images that you took from the drone. Tell us what you did with them.
We use a specific algorithm that are able to reconstruct a 3D model based on a 2D picture. So we can put in this program thousands of pictures from everything and put all together in a 3D scene and reconstruct automatically the model of Palmyra. And this model is so accurate that it is photorealistic.
So this exhibit is called From Bamiyan to Palmyra, right? Bamiyan being the site of those large statues of Buddha blown up by extremists in Afghanistan over a decade ago. Is it your belief that all this patrimony, regardless of where it is, can be saved and eventually rebuilt?
Yeah. Heritage can be rebuilt digitally. I mean, this is easy to do.
I mean, in Afghanistan, the Taliban is still acting out violently. How does the attention paid to historic sites like Palmyra address the goal of fighting and eliminating ISIS?
I think it's the same fight we have in Afghanistan and in Syria. What the Taliban did in Bamiyan 15 years ago, it's exactly the same thing that ISIS tried to do now in Palmyra. And our fight is about the culture, and we use a picture in order to show to people, to everybody, how nice are this site. And I think it's a response to those violent people who try to destroy completely those sites. In a way, if we show every people how nice are this site, I think it's the best response we can do for those people.
You think an appreciation of culture can help to eliminate violence?
Yeah, because the problem is this kind of destruction is a result of ignorance. And if we give these people the culture and a way to love this heritage, I think we can fight this violence in this way.
So the Paris exhibit gives us a digital picture of Palmyra's historic treasures. When do you think preservationists might be able to actually enter Palmyra and start, you know, restoration work? I mean, time's not exactly on your side. You probably think about that a lot.
We don't know. We are waiting. We hope we can quickly make something on the ground. But for now, it's just not the time.
Yves Ubelman, the architect behind the effort to save the historic sites of Palmyra in Syria, speaking with us from Paris. Yves, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Like all technologies, unmanned aerial vehicles are neutral. It's what we humans do with the technology that changes that. Using drones to inspect historic monuments? Constructive. Using drones to kill people? Destructive. Singer-songwriter Piers Ficini was disturbed by the destructive use of drones. Ficini is a Brit, now living in southern France. And on his latest album, he was inspired to write songs about events as they unfolded, singing history as it happens.
The kind of genesis of the whole thing was, how can I respond as a songwriter to current events? How can I write songs basically in real time?
One of those events was a drone strike in Syria. Ficini's song, Drone, is told from the point of view of a narrator who lost their brother in a village that was accidentally bombed by a drone.
I saw my town disappear in smoke, dust and debris on the air we choked. Vengeance comes with a savage fist, cold as metal in the morning mist. Drone by day, killer by day, drone by night, put the bones away. Drone by night, killer by day, drone by night, put the bones away.
I think what makes a song kind of powerful is when you can evoke someone, you know, a character, or you can evoke a story. As a singer, I deliberately kept that in the first person so that I can embody that voice and make it more touching.
Now my brother is lying in rest, head to the east and his feet to the west. Search for prayer but the words won't come. Won't stop trying and his blood still runs. Drone by night, killer by day, drone. Promenade at the bones away. Promenade, kill a bad day. Promenade at the bones away.
If you examine the sort of this idea of very kind of loose or broad notion of the troubadour, the first European songwriters, in a way, if you like, they were storytellers, but they were basically, you know, a war would happen, so which was, you know, current affairs, and they would basically have to recount, you know, those events. At least that's how I imagined it, in a way.
A drone attack is just one of several current events Piers Ficini sings about. There's also a song about the 2015 terrorist attacks in Paris. He's also got a tune inspired by Donald Trump's promise to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. There's been no shortage of things that prompt a song from Piers Ficini. His main challenge is to come up with songs that don't dwell on misery. But Ficini has a solution for that. It's called rhythm.
We're living through a turbulent moment in history. And, you know, there's no kind of glossing over that. But I think ultimately the kind of dance or if you like, rhythmic percussive aspect of the music is very important, because within the music, there is the flame of hope.
I Dreamed an Island is Piers Ficini's sixth album. Here's some of the tune Bring Down the Wall from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Bring down the wall, break it. Stone by stone, bring down the wall, shake it to the bone, tear down the rock, take it, go, 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 tear down the rock, make a tear go slow. Throw down.
PRI, Public Radio International.